Thanks very much, David. And next, I think we'll hear from John Steiner from Kaiser and HMO Research Network.
Thank you for having me here this morning. I'm really representing three concentric circles of research departments. I'm the director of the Institute for Health Research at Kaiser Permanente in Colorado. We're a integrated delivery system for 500,000 individuals. We've had an Epic-based electronic medical record since 2004 and a legacy EMR prior to that time. Our research department locally is actually 115 people, and as I'll talk about, a subset of a larger group of affiliated research departments across integrated delivery systems. Even in a population of 500,000, we are able to do research using our health information technology that has substantial clinical and public health importance. Recent examples of our work include demonstrating that a very substantial increase in the rate of immunization-preventable diseases amongst children who don't receive timely immunizations. We've been able to show that Medicare Advantage patients in Kaiser, Colorado demonstrate reduced medication adherence when they reach the donut hole. Most recently, we're showing that clinical pharmacists can, using home blood pressure readings that are added by patients to an interactive website, can manage blood pressure medications and reduce blood pressure in a satisfactory way. Kaiser Colorado is part of a larger group of research departments within Kaiser nationally. Six of the eight Kaiser regions have research departments with a total of about 1,000 researchers. In 2009 alone, this group was a recipient of over $54 million in ARRA funding for comparative effectiveness and other research. Kaiser recently has made a substantial investment in the infrastructure of our research units through what we're calling the Center for Effectiveness and Safety Research, which is enabling us to continue to develop our virtual data warehouses to more effectively link our administrators in efficiencies around contracting, IRB, and other important research functions, to coordinate our investigators, to decide what projects are worth pursuing and what investigators across Kaiser regions are going to involve those projects, and to develop a data coordinating center to assist researchers from the various sites in accomplishing their studies. We're also undertaking a couple of proof of concept projects looking at blood sugar control in diabetics undergoing total joint replacement, and looking at the impact of the recent H1N1 epidemic on pregnant women in our integrated delivery systems. The goal of this is to develop actionable research results within a year of the inception of the project. A real critique of research within integrated delivery systems traditionally has been that the pace of research is so much slower than the pace of operational decisions, and we're really trying to see to what extent the efficiencies that we have through our increasingly integrated research model can accelerate the pace of discovery and implementation of research findings. The largest circle that we're a part of is the HMO Research Network, which includes most of the Kaiser regions as well as other large integrated delivery systems geographically dispersed in the United States. Geisinger is actually a member of that consortium. Collectively, the HMO Research Network contains electronic medical record data for over 12 million patients. The major initiative that we're engaged in now is a discussion with the director of the NIH around establishing a so-called collaboratory, which would make the HMO Research Network essentially a national research resource. All of these research efforts are based on two critical things. The first is the existence of a virtual data warehouse at each of our sites. This has required extensive and costly development to assure that we have identically named and defined variables that are adapted from each of our individual systems. The second is a distributed research network, which is a way basically of querying and interacting with those virtual data warehouses. that allows investigators and programmers at one site to basically send code to other sites to identify patients who are eligible for studies or to create data sets to conduct a particular study. We were asked to talk about some of the guiding principles that are at work within these research consortia. I think the first such principle is that we are stewards rather than owners of the data. We hold the data on behalf of the members and on behalf of the employees of those organizations, distinct from traditional academic researchers who collect the data and feel that they own it. The data really aren't ours. We have them on behalf of our patients, and that establishes a lot of obligations on us with respect to confidentiality of data and restriction of the information to the minimum amount of data necessary to address a particular research question. I think the second guiding principle is to explore and expand the richness of our data. Many entities have claims data that have transactional information, sometimes pharmacy information. The data within our integrated delivery systems is far richer than that. We have the results of lab tests. We have easy access to free text information from notes and pathology reports and so forth. And so, and as we develop into the e-health era, we now have information from telephone contacts, from electronic contacts, email contacts between clinicians and patients that are really the source of the next generation of research. I think the final guiding principle is almost obsessive attention to detail. A lot of people believe that doing research within integrated delivery systems is as simple as pushing a button. It's actually far harder than that. The transactional data need extensive transformation into the high-quality data necessary for research. In my shop in Colorado, we have 15 data programmers and database managers who are basically engaged full-time in moving data from these original databases into research-ready files. This attention to detail is what allows us to do research that's of relevance to the public good.
Thank you very much for those comments. And I'd now like to turn to Michael Raymer. And Michael, I'll try to get your slides started up at the same time.
Thanks very much for the opportunity to describe what our customers are doing today. Rather than talk about Microsoft products, I'd rather talk about some of the accomplishments of our customers. And I chose to focus on the Wisconsin Health Exchange. So if you could advance the slide once. The Wisconsin Health Exchange today involves connection of over 40 hospitals, 120 clinics. We're processing a large number of transactions there, and we're able to implement it in a relatively short period of time in 5 months. The goal was for the EDs to be able to coordinate care on a geographical basis around that area. And one of the intentional designs of the application was to also aggregate de-identified data so it could be reused on a future basis for public health surveillance potential projects. I thought I'd take a moment if you advance the next slide and just talk about a little bit about what it looks like to the physician at each of the ED clinics. It provides a patient summary view, much of what Mark and others have articulated today, in providing a summary of the medications that they're on, the allergies, any encounters they've had throughout the region. You can see on this particular patient, just a sample patient, 5 emergency encounters, and then also to have a scalable data model over time. And so one of the things that we're talking about over time is also the availability of images, so that you're reducing the amount of duplicate radiology procedures that are done in a particular geography. With that as a background, it's very non-invasive to the clinician. They simply look at the screen as kind of the upfront process of assessment and intake of the patient. Forward to the next screen, what I wanted to do was relate a problem that they had in Wisconsin. I think you'll need to hit one more, Mark, and one more again. I apologize. Didn't realize it had a build. But in 1993, they had a problem during a significant flood in Wisconsin where over 400,000 residents fell ill before really anyone was aware of the problem. Actually, the pharmacies reported a run on Imodium on the counter, and that was the first indication that they had a problem. And actually, dozens of people died just related to this particular incident around flooding. Let's flash forward to 2008. if you'll hit the next slide, Mark. They had a re-incident of the worst flood in 50 years. They had taken the public water system, they'd installed new filters, but the question was, did the public works improve, and was the water supply safe at this time? If you advance to the next slide, we're immediately able in the Wisconsin Health Exchange to compare the outcomes of any presentation at the ED of how it varied between the Wisconsin waterworks and the other areas covered by the exchange. And you can see there was very little variation. So they realized that they had solved the problem that had been generated in 1993. So just a real quick example of something that you wouldn't necessarily have thought of when you were tilting up a health exchange, but by having de-identified data, you're able to rapidly produce this information without any impact or additional work on the part of the clinician. Another example, if you had advanced, Mark, would be really looking at H1N1. And so here's just a graph of the incidence of flu over the past year, and you can see also their ability to break it down by age, the individual presenting themselves at any of the locations of care throughout that catchment area. Advance one more slide. I thought I'd talk just a moment about what has the impact been of having availability and coordination of care. Has that really been utilized by clinicians, and have they seen it to make a difference? So the University of Wisconsin is in the process of publishing this data in the scholarly publication. What they've identified is about 42% of the time availability of this data is actually making a difference. If you advance the next slide, we drove down a little bit more to see the actual impact on ordering. And you've seen about 48% of the time we've seen a decrease in labs. Some physicians have referenced and believe that they are actually increasing the number of labs as a result of having access to this information, because maybe it's caused them to be curious about another matter because they have a more holistic view of the patient, about 23% no change. Seen a pretty significant decrease in the number of medication orders, and same thing on imaging orders. So the projected savings looks to be about $50 to $150 per person. Interestingly enough, the health exchange now is actually on an encounter basis being compensated by both Humana and Blue Cross and Blue Shield at basically $5 per patient interaction if the exchange is utilized in the course of the intake of that patient. And it's just demonstrating they looked at the data historically and were able to correlate and see that the exchange was making quite a difference. So as we think about it, what are we trying to accomplish in solutions, whether we're building them for enterprises or consumers, it's really three things. One is that we really want to liberate data from the silos and make sure that data is flowing in the appropriate way in a, both a secure and private fashion. Secondly, we want to empower both at the clinician level, but also the consumer. And I think many times the consumer is left out of the equation. And we found in a variety of instances around our partners as customers around the country that really we've had very great involvement on the part of the consumer. The third thing is that we really want to also, in addition to aggregation, and in liberating the data, we want to also connect care in a way that has not been done historically. So in doing that, there's kind of four principles we look at from a technology perspective, being for Microsoft. You look at any problem, and it's like when you have a hammer in your hand, everything looks like a nail. But from a technology perspective, we think of four things. One is an adaptable data model. So the fact is data is not always in pristine condition from its source system. But we rely upon the fact that both clinicians are really intelligent. And the fact of the matter is sometimes even though the data may not be purely aligned, that they have the ability to interpret that to help the care delivery process. Secondly, we really believe in aggregated de-identified data. One of the things that we're concerned about is the health exchanges today are not routinely putting that as a center. And much of the results that we've seen at Wisconsin would not be possible without the access to de-identified data. Performance and scale is really important, and finally, consumer engagement.
Thanks very much, Michael. Really appreciate the comments. What I'd like to do is start off with a few of my own questions to get some discussion going, and just to put you all on notice, I'd like you all to ask some follow-ups and carry this conversation along further, and then we're going to open it up to everyone here. And just kind of going back in order, Jim, back to you. As I understand it, you mentioned your recent Beacon Grant. Congratulations, just awarded last week. As I understand it, a key element of that is to take what you've done within the Geisinger system, which is a pretty integrated set of providers with supporting data systems and the like, and try to extend it out to other providers in the region who historically haven't been so electronically connected, let alone integrated in a more coordinated way like your own providers. Seems like that's a much tougher challenge than the kinds of steps that you've described that you've been able to accomplish in recent years within Geisinger. Am I seeing that the right way, and how are you all approaching it?
It is a big challenge, particularly making the business case, and we think that HHS's, the cumulative effect of HHS's actions and legislation are already to have changed that so that there is a stronger business case than there used to be. But we do, in the Beacon community, we are including hospitals, clinics, long-term care facilities, home health, and then consumers, patients, and their caregivers all in trying to build a linked web of both care processes, which is probably the hardest part of it, and integrated information. And so, yes, that is a big challenge. We have done all of the pieces of that somewhere in some kind of opportunistic, chaotic sort of way. What the Beacon community gives us an opportunity to do is to put it all together into an integrated set of services that from the potential purchaser, we intend to be selling this service in 3 years. From the standpoint of a payer or a hospital or a clinic or a consumer or patient, we intend to be able to say, here is an integrated set of services, simple to use, one interface for you, fits the way that you think about doing things, whichever one of those players you are, and we will save you more money than we charge you, and be able to demonstrate that. So that's an enormous challenge. We're very excited about it.
Uh-huh. And you'll be able to show that, so we'll definitely keep in touch about that. Bob, you've got you're coming at this from a somewhat different perspective. Your providers weren't so integrated as the foundation that Geisinger has been building on, but you mentioned stakeholder-directed goals as being able to bring together, I heard this from several panelists, stakeholder-directed goals as being a good way to bring together these broader efforts for sharing information and generating capacity to deliver better care for patients through coordination, but also these population health, better population health information and the like. As I understand it, you've been doing this mainly through shared goals and not the kind of financial business case that Jim just mentioned. Is that an issue? Is it going to be an issue going forward? How do you see building on the momentum that you have already through all of these policy changes that are coming?
Okay. Great question. Actually, our approach is more or less the opposite approach, where we started with a push from employers, the hospitals and the physicians and the plans got together and said we need to do something. Back in 96, we said maybe this internet thing's going to stay around. We can pull this together and make it work. But then the concept of having a neutral hub to pull it together, it really made a huge difference. But right from the beginning, we said, we want to operate this thing as a business. We need to make this sustainable. If we can't figure out a business case for any piece of this that somebody will actually pay for, then we won't do it. So over 12 years, something like 3% of our revenue is from grants. The rest is from customers that are paying us for the service. And in virtually every case, they see a very specific ROI from their interaction with the Health Information Exchange.
And is that primarily because of a demonstrated impact on quality of care and efficiency of care, or other
it, things? It is more around the efficiency of the administrative processes. How much does it really cost you to, you know, to print and mail a result versus sending it electronically? What does it really cost you to do an EMR interface with that big group that's coming to pound on you and make you do it? And then, you know, what kind of liabilities come along with that? So it's really, you know, fairly low-level administrative, you know, calculations of, well, wait a minute, you mean I can send this data to you and you'll send it to all the EMRs and so forth and so on, that, you know, the hospital CIOs look at that and say, wow, sign me up. The issue around population health, and we do some pretty interesting things there. Because we have a standardized data flow that comes through one central point, we're able to syndromic surveillance. I mean, every emergency department in the community automatically has non-PHI data used in syndromic surveillance. We realized that we could quickly identify certain reportable diseases and route them, because we know who the patient is and where they live. We can route them to the correct local public health department for almost no incremental cost. But putting together the larger population health business model and figuring out, you know, who's going to step up and make that work for us, that's, you know, what we're really, you know, beginning to tackle now.
Mm-hmm. And any answers yet?
Well, I want to think that we can really build on the success of the collaboration and the communication that's happened. In fact, our esteemed moderator here is coming to Cincinnati in a week or two to oversee a meeting that I hope will help us launch this. And we're really moving toward the whole notion of triple aim that gets, you know, to the, you know, the care and the health and the cost. With some energized employers and hopefully re-energized health plans coming in to look at, what can you do in a community with a systems approach, and, you know, this data infrastructure to build on to really begin to address that.
Now, David, you emphasized some similar themes about the value of having kind of a neutral convener, neutral forum for bringing together all the stakeholders to help them identify common goals and then address those goals. And going forward, as you're facing these kind of bigger challenges but bigger opportunities in terms of sharing data, improving care, fulfilling this potential for enhanced uses. You highlighted the importance of communication and clear messages about what was going on to bring along those rural providers and the consumers in South Carolina. How did the financial incentives, you know, this broad set of HHS-based financial incentives and maybe private sector incentives fit in with that?
Well, they've been an enormous assistance. I mean, we began really leveraging the warehouse because of the lack of a value proposition for providers. Back in 2006, the question was the empty HIE question. How can you connect enough providers to make this worthwhile? And so we first tried to provide value out of the box with an existing resource, and also leveraging safety net providers in the state as both sort of participants in a prototype, but also they're very, very important in the engagement of the rest of the provider community, to the point now that our governance is essentially made up in part of these types of providers, as well as the hospital association to guide us. And then last but not least, since we mentioned meaningful use, that's really essential to the business model for sustainability for something like SkyX. We've kept the cost low by leveraging existing resources, and then the incentives figure mightily into the business decisions of the providers when they look at the cost of actually paying for a connection. And so through the collaboration and messaging, we have the associations essentially getting the message out that this is a good thing and that it's necessary, affording you the opportunity to explain that it's remarkably low cost relative to some other things that providers often do. And then you have some champions that help explain the quality benefits going forward. We had, for example, our pilot actually, through a project funded by HRSA, actually got all of their clinicians to 100% compliance with the standard of care for diabetics. You can't say enough of the value of those sorts of statements from physician champions to other physicians rather than someone from the state.
So it sounds like you're seeing, given the priorities that you identify locally among your stakeholders, you're seeing enough opportunities to go out and connect, whether it's a HRSA funding or new meaningful use funding. You see plenty of potential to build on there. It hasn't been.
Absolutely. And as some of the external uses of the HIE, Medicaid is in South Carolina is one of our core partners and have been from the very beginning, reporting and supporting their disbursement of those funds as part of the secondary mission of the exchange and supporting that. And it also, again, allows you to explain that to the providers themselves.
John, you all are at a very sophisticated point in terms of being able to conduct these population-level or subpopulation-level studies. And I'm wondering if you can help us think a little bit about scaling up beyond what you're doing already. I mean, as you mentioned, there's a lot of interest even from the director of NIH in turning the what is a tremendous national resource for this HMO research network into something it can do even faster, more extensive support for clinical trials. It's 11 million, 12 million people. That's tremendous. But we're really aiming for a healthcare system that would be potentially much larger and even more diverse than that. Yet as you get out of these integrated systems where you can have this very careful attention, as you emphasize, to getting the data right and making sure it is truly comparable and the conclusions are appropriate, it seems like that might get more challenging. Any thoughts on expanding out this model to a much more diverse and broader population of providers and healthcare delivery systems?
Well, I think that's taking a number of directions. I think one example that's underway that I know you and others at Brookings already know about is the FDA Mini Sentinel initiative that is really trying to detect adverse events of pharmaceuticals in a population of in the short term, 100 million individuals. Obviously, not all of those have electronic medical records of the depth and sophistication of the integrated delivery systems. The first step is that we in the integrated delivery systems can essentially back create files that resemble those of other settings so that we can add our data to the data that exists in these other entities. If you're trying to detect a signal, a drug adverse effect that is often rare but significant in a drug that isn't prescribed commonly, you really need these large populations that you're alluding to. We think that the less detailed claims files, encounter files, pharmaceutical files of other entities are excellent at signal detection. And then the way that integrates with what the HMOs and integrated systems can do is really signal verification. If you believe that a certain drug is causing low platelet counts, then you need to be able to drill into the medical records and confirm that the low platelet counts are due to the drug exposure and not to other things. So that's one way in which the two, the more detailed and the broader data sets can interact, I think, to address healthcare surveillance problems. I think the other thing is that we think that increasingly systems outside integrated delivery systems are going to be adopting EMRs. It's really a topic of discussion here today. And the other thing that we're really trying to develop is ways of doing work together. Others have alluded to the problem of IRB review. That can cause chaos if each individual IRB is required to take a look at the study to make modifications to the consent form that then contradict the suggestions made by a prior IRB at another institution. So models of contracting across multiple sites, which delays projects, models of centralized or seeded IRB review that allows projects to go forward more rapidly, and then certainly models of data exchange, how the virtual data warehouse model that we're developing here, and ways of extracting data through distributed research networks. These are all things that we think, while we're testing them in our current systems, are potentially scalable to other systems with similar data as EMRs become more common.
And Michael, from your standpoint, you emphasize some of the same points about building off distributed data systems and having mechanisms for contributing elements or summary information from those systems to these larger scale projects. You highlighted some regional public health efforts in Wisconsin, also some use of summarized data, it sounds like, for payments, for quality-related payments from Humana and Blue Cross. Is that going to be scalable, too? Can that get to, for example, the level of supporting CMS payment reforms and the Innovation Center, accountable care, things like that? What needs to happen?
Well, I think, we have a number of our customers today that are looking at the implementation of accountable care organizations, and, of course, that road is a little murky. But I think what it involves is really unification of data that historically has been stored in various silos. So a organization that wants to be accountable for both the cost and quality of care in a catchment area many times is having to engage with other providers that provide services that they don't typically do. So we're working with one healthcare system today that's had to go out, secure relationships with a skilled nursing provider, with a physical therapy company, at the same time importing data from the payer. And historically, there have not been good data systems and data models that really can ingest data from those various sources to provide a fundamental foundation for analytics on that. And so we believe the model that we've implemented at Wisconsin is extensible and applicable in an accountable care organization. I think one of the interesting opportunities will be for health exchanges to think about themselves as their business model as being the data engine for an accountable care organization. So, I think if I was responsible for a health exchange, my main objective would be to align myself with the accountable care organizations that are springing forward in any kind of geography, because I think it provides an important independence element. They're already are gaining sources of all that data, and, rather than tilting up something completely different.
Interesting. I just a follow-up question for all of you based on this, and take you back to the first panel where Farzad emphasized that you want to keep it simple but deal with the complexity and the importance of these public health and quality issues systematically as well, and that it sounded like the approach that they are emphasizing is to find particular pieces, not try to do everything at once, but particular pieces, particular issues that could be scaled up to even the national level, maybe as part of accountable care organizations, as part of public health initiatives and the like. What's your sense, and just any of you, of what might be the most promising elements or incremental but important steps in getting to this, getting to these goals nationally? We heard about lab results as one where some limited work on standards done consistently could potentially make a big difference. Is that something that would be on the list? What would be some other concrete examples?
One of the things that we realized as we were preparing the Beacon plan is that what is often needed in a community of care is a fairly constrained set of data. And Farzad is exactly right about, med list, problem list, allergies, recent results. That's one, but there's this other set of information sets, like what are the things you need to manage a patient with congestive heart failure? Say there's about 44 data elements that you need for that. What do you need to take care of a patient with COPD, with lung disease? And so one of the things that we're doing is identifying the minimum data set, the adequate data set for each one of these populations, and then creating a simple web tool that enables physician, case manager, patient, whoever is appropriate, long-term care facility, home health nurse, to enter that data and to update that data and then create a simplified view that is optimized in terms of making it easy for a user to look at that and sort of see the whole thing and understand the patient rapidly. And so I think that's one way that we'll do the kind of simple task focus, but all of it will be linked to standards. All of it will be semantically interoperable So that I think one of the ways we see this developing is we will sort of build out those data sets over time to where they serve more and more different kinds of patients, more and more different kinds of cases. Patients, another simple example is, stolen from Google and Microsoft, but patients will be able to put their med list into a simple tool and make that part of the health information exchange, which we are using as the engine or the hub for the Beacon community. And then it'll be the same thing. A doc can do that. A case manager can do the med list. One of the things we found out is that clinicians, even our ultra-wired clinicians, say we can never tell what the patient's med list is in the nursing home. And so one of the things we're going to do is have enable nursing homes to enter the patient's med list. And then that list will be available throughout the community, and you'll be able to see who entered it and when. And then obviously part of the role of the professional is to say, well, that's someone I know, and that's recent enough that's probably right. But what you always do is review that and update it yourself anyway. So one of the reasons it doesn't have to be perfect, as long as professionals are using it, is because even if you give me a year-old med list entered by Aunt Edna, that's a lot better than starting at zero. And I can go through and update it.
Other suggestions?
Well, I think the role of the consumer is really important in that a number of our problems in terms of cost control is at the fundamental level about behavioral modification on the part of the patient. And so having, I think, more of a electronic communication capability with the patient over time that doesn't just rely upon the screen of a PC, but leverages other smartphones, PDAs, et cetera, in terms of engaging the patient in managing their health in a more proactive way. You know, we believe that it's the stimulus funding and ARRA and high-tech funding aimed at engaging the patient and family electronically, we think is a really important step.
And how is it, how exactly to implement that, though? As you've seen with the ARRA funding, the meaningful use funding, it looks like it's going to be tied, at least over time, to demonstrating that the health IT is being used to accomplish something. What's the way to capture that for these aspects of patient involvement? Could maybe follow Amanda's approach of just asking whether patients are satisfied. They're all satisfied. I'm not sure if that's going to really accomplish the goal. How can you really push that along?
Well, I think Cleveland Clinic's done some really interesting work in this space, particularly with congestive heart failure patients, and really utilizing home-based monitoring tools to capture data electronically, whether it be weight gain on a scale, whether it be use of a spirometer in the home, pulse oximeter, blood pressure, et cetera. And they've had a trial study they've been doing in the Cleveland area that, at least for that population of patients, has demonstrated significant and actually zero readmissions in that period of time by more appropriately managing the patient. Probably the most famous example of that was in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. They did a front page story of a truck driver that was one of these congestive heart failure patients that each day at the end of his day would actually utilize what devices he had been given by Cleveland Clinic to measure his vitals. He uploaded them to Health Vault wirelessly from his truck, and his physician was in turn interacting with that in a seamless workflow basis to adjust medications, et cetera, and really engaging the patient collaboratively in that process. We've also done work in the Health Vault area with Whatcom County, which has implemented this idea of a shared care plan, which is integrating both the responsibilities of the patient or the consumer integrated with the responsibilities of the case manager or caregiver or primary care physician. And they've shown great success in that interaction model in terms of improving the patient's health and also reducing the cost of care in that particular catchment area. So early examples, there's still a long way to go, but I think the very first step is to encourage the providers to provide that electronic access. What we see, and I think probably Google would agree also, is we're not seeing patients randomly waking up one morning deciding they need a personal health record. That is usually stimulated through the provider, and there's been a number of recent studies that have indicated that.
There is a group in New Zealand that has tested and shown improved patient outcomes. I think it was pediatric obesity, where they have basically an educational curriculum that they've chopped up into little modules that they send on cell phones. And so the participant just gets a cell phone message every couple of days, and they are showing benefit. And that's one of the things that there is probably a place for larger scale development, even federally funded national development of a set of curricula that would be reusable rather than all of us creating our own.
Let's think about engaging the consumer using a systems approach. So if we have health information exchange that people are sending data to, and we know who the patient is, and we can automatically populate the personal health record, then there begins to be value there for the patient. But beyond that, if we can actually build the links to the physician office environment such that there is an improvement in workflow, rather than somebody picking up and calling the patient, they can see that the patient has the personal health record, they can push the button and actually deliver the result and document that it's been done. And then to really reach out there, what if we can engage the employers in a way that they can incent their employees to participate with a personal health record and use it? All of these different characters interact with each other, and if you can pull them together, I think we're a lot more likely to be successful in driving this kind of change.
Other comments to add to this? Anything you want to ask each other, or any clarifying or add-ons?
One question about looking for particularly post-marketing surveillance of drugs. There are a number of European countries that have very sophisticated active surveillance of databases, and that would, if we could work together, that would get us up to a few hundred million pretty quickly. Is there any effort to get that linked?
I don't have a definitive answer to that. I think obviously what the FDA has been focusing on is getting us to talk to ourselves first,
yeah.
and which is an accomplishment in its own right. I think it's really only under the Mini Sentinel initiative that's just been initiated where we're really starting to have the conversation between the integrated delivery systems and the other holders of relevant data about how to work together to do this even domestically.
And just speaking on from the experience with taking those steps so far, it really does take some efforts to make sure that you've described for the HMO Research Network that a diabetic patient in one plan is the same as in another, the medications are being measured in the same way, especially the outcomes or the complications are being measured in a consistent way. And that gets back to the broader discussion we've been having here today about the need for practical standards, maybe not standards for everything, but at least practical consistency that for some important drug or medical product safety problems or vaccine safety problems, there are going to be some issues that arise. There just always are in trying to put data from different systems together. But through an appropriate process, those can be addressed. And it sounds like from what you all are saying, you believe that the same thing can happen for patient-entered information, for developing the key data elements or multiple sources for particular common health problems, and for solving or addressing some of these other issues in quality measurement or effectiveness studies or things like that. It isn't going to happen automatically. It is going to take some work, but it's getting the sense that you all think these are manageable steps now, especially with the funding and infrastructure that's increasingly available. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, we're on a road there's no turning back from, I think, at this point. And while the standards aren't fully developed, I think a lot of the sort of practical experience that you can gain from attempting to harmonize the data elements and to make them move, I think, are valuable to the process itself.
At the same time, though, there's no magic bullet that, boom, we'll implement a set of standards and all of this will just happen automatically. Yeah, so it is going to be some real work. I'd like to open up to comments from all of you who are here. Raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. And again, be sure to identify who you are and please ask your question.
Yeah. My name is George Pantos. I'm executive director of the Health Performance Management Institute, which is a think tank that is doing precisely what the panelists have been discussing, to promote the notion of member engagement and to use technology to measure and manage how health plans operate and how they perform. I was wondering, in terms of a discussion here today, which seems to be also, Mark, in your earlier comments, you mentioned performance management principles. I was wondering whether the focus of the electronic health record, as you have been discussing it, is aimed at people who are ill and go for care, which seems to be the emphasis that I got, or whether it also could be focused toward prevention. Because one of the important components of saving and health outcomes is to be able to prevent illness. And this gets kind of mixed up in all the buzz out there. And yet it seems to me that if member engagement is directed toward getting people educated about their health and adopting a healthy lifestyle, that certainly being able to get the data they need to be able to take those paths is critical. But yet the electronic health record is seems to be presented as a static document rather than one that has the ability to provide the data for people to take action on the consumer side. So I wondered if you could just anybody comment on, maybe Michael would be the best one on this because of Microsoft's involvement, but isn't there a dimension here for prevention?
We would absolutely agree. I think part of the challenge has been is that we're not incented to prevent. The incentives today are perverse on the provider side, and I think that a lot of the inertia now is toward enabling information systems to be in place to change the reimbursement system to be more driven toward outcomes. We certainly have seen in countries where they are the payer and the provider, where the use of our systems have been to engage the family or the family caregiver or the individual directly more on preventive services and leveraging our technology to be able to accomplish that. So I think the framework is being put in place. But until the reimbursement changes to really incentivize the preventive elements, I think it's going to be difficult to get the whole system to move in a more unified way.
That was part of our motivation in South Carolina to begin with. I mean, our exchange really grew out of support for care coordination models. Now, it had a human component that I think eventually will have a much larger electronic counterpart with a care coordinator or a case manager having the dialogue with the patient. But back to the incentives, I think, would need to move in that direction, and then the electronic or technological wherewithal to do that more effectively directly with a patient would need to move in that direction. But as a principle, that's really where we've been all along.
You know, within the integrated delivery systems, the incentives are so much better aligned. First of all, we have members, not just patients. And when you're thinking about prevention, you're thinking about all your members, not just, as you say, the ones who choose to access care. Kaiser knows all the women over 50 who need mammograms. It doesn't rely on them to come in for a medical office visit to remind them that it's time to get their mammograms. Through some of the patient portals that Kaiser has developed, if you fill out a personal health assessment that's on record, then individual prevention reminders, if you need cholesterol screening, bone density, immunizations, what have you, then you can basically outreach through electronic means, through emails. This happens for me and my family as Kaiser members. So I think where the incentives are aligned, where there's an incentive toward and certainly no disincentive against prevention, we can see a much expanded use of these electronic tools to achieve prevention goals.
Jim, you also have an integrated system.
So internally, we've documented things like we were above national benchmark on flu vaccines. when we started running, letting the database send automatic reminders to patients who are at high risk for flu annually, and by the way, we use U.S. mail if that's the patient's preferred communication channel, or the networked PHR if that's what they prefer. We increased uptake the first year 15%, and it's increased every year since. At, of course, decreased administrative costs. And not what we're doing in the Beacon community is going out to mosques and synagogues and churches and PTOs and anybody else that'll have us in the community and reaching out to, that's why I always say consumers and patients, and enabling those people to say, yes, I'd like to get a flu shot reminder and be on a list that automatically, annually, I get a flu shot and a recommendation on where to go consistent with my care providers and all that. So, you know, there's clearly, that is happening. The issue now is to find ways to reach out to people. You can do things like say, okay, case managers that have patients that are never see a Geisinger clinician, are completely outside of Geisinger, why don't we have them enroll their patients in this kind of electronic reminder system? What are the ways to get out to the community so that just people out in the community have an option to say, oh, I'm 50 years old, it's a good idea to get a colonoscopy, where would I get that? How would, you know? So I think we have, again, we have the tools, we've done it. The question is putting it together in a system that really runs end to end.
And these broader-based efforts, those of you who are bookending this panel have pretty complete electronic records for your integrated care populations. These broader-based efforts are much more limited electronic records, correct? I mean, you've identified some specific clinical problems that are of interest to the population of consumers or patients that you're serving.
Yeah.
You've got a limited electronic capability related to that, and it's focused both on the patient or the personal responses and improving care for them, but also a basis for some of these reimbursement changes or population health measurement or something like that.
Right. But because of our setting, ours is the absolute lowest tech possible. All you have to have is an internet-capable computer.
Got it.
We're finding that the stakeholders beyond the patients themselves that are really interested in prevention are the employers, particularly the big self-employed folks. They have a word I hadn't heard before, presenteeism. It's very important to them, and we really hope to get them engaged in this process to motivate and push and incentivize employees from one direction while we're catching them on the more traditional health system side with the personal health record and ultimately a community-wide registry to be able to flow the kind of reminders. But I think the employer engagement and them seeing a direct benefit that they can measure in terms of people being at work will really help us moving forward.
Other questions? I know we had one over here and then back there.
I'm Landon Bain from CDISC, a standards organization. For Dr. Steiner, are the data in your research database identified or are they anonymized? And also, can you give a couple of examples of research uses of that data?
Sure. The basic principle is that in the federated model that we have, the identifiable data remain within the institution, so that when an inquiry goes out for if an investigator at one center is doing a multi-site study, they send out an inquiry for data that is de-identified at the host institution. Either a summary table of data is created, or if necessary, the data are appropriately de-identified, pushed back to the investigator who assembles the final data set for analysis. So by the time they're touched outside an individual institution, they are de-identified. The examples are many. I think one that comes to mind is that three HMOs, Kaiser Colorado, Northern California, and Health Partners in Minnesota, have been collaborating on a series of studies on a disease as common as hypertension. We have a data set with over 1 million patients with rich clinical information about hypertension treatment that enables us to start to ask questions that will never be asked in conventional randomized trials. For example, given that you're on a certain first-line treatment for hypertension, what's the relative benefit of different second-stage treatments for the same disease? If you're on a diuretic, a thiazide, should you be on a beta blocker or an ACE inhibitor in various combinations? The cost to study those critically important questions in conventional randomized trials is basically unfeasible. So through this kind of comparative effectiveness research, we're able to address questions that really must be asked and that can't be asked other than in these sort of naturally occurring.
And that's a pretty complex study design, it sounds like, looking at secondary medications and patients who probably have multiple illnesses and other issues at the same time, still done with de-identified data beyond the individual institutions that are participating?
Correct.
Next question over here.
Good morning.
Go ahead, and then
sure.
Over here. Go ahead.
My name's Alistair Matheson from the National Association.
I'm Malcolm Lovell. Oh,
start in the back, and then you're next.
From the National Association of County and City Health Officials. Several of you have talked about public health, and we represent local health departments. One of the challenges of not having public health at the table at the start is that when you come to do secondary data use, it's very challenging. And in Wisconsin, there's a good example. Many of the data fields like chief complaint and race are free text, which is, I'm sure, very helpful for the physician when he or she is typing it in, but not very useful for when public health want to use it for syndromic surveillance. So a two-part question. One is, how do you get public health agencies to the table at the start? How do you incentivize them to do that? And then secondly, how do you balance the needs, workflow needs of the physicians and then the needs of public health workers?
And it sounds like race and ethnicity data that's standardized is a key issue from your standpoint.
Yeah, for certainly for looking at disparities, but even chief complaint for syndromic surveillance.
I'll start from our side. Public health is literally a partner in our HIE collaborative grant. In fact, the three primary partners are State Budget and Control Board, which I represent, the Department of Health and Environmental Control, which is our separate health department, and Medicaid really came together to form the core of that, building on work that was already done. How did we get them at the table? Well, actually, it's almost like any of the other relationships that you've heard. You find literally a win-win for all the agencies. In their case, one of their key points of pain was the population of the immunization registry, which had been done through sort of a standalone platform that providers really found impossible to use given its impact on their workflow. So by going directly through the exchange, you again eliminate the need on the provider side of having someone second key any of this information, yet you have a more complete registry. And we're moving there from the immunization registry on towards reportable diseases and reportable labs. And so from our perspective, those are the kinds of discussions that need to take place within state government just to harmonize all of those needs and desires.
We see public health as a very important player in health information exchange. They are a natural ally of the health information exchange because they have a need to get data, to get it locally, and to be able to utilize it across all sources. So we've had a public health board seat from the beginning of HealthBridge. The fact that the data comes through a single control point and it touches our master patient index has proved to be very valuable for public health because, for some reason, the labs don't always have phone numbers and addresses and things like that. So just touching that master patient index has really added value for the data that we flow to the local health departments. In a very similar flow, and I don't want to get into the competing health department constituencies, but the same data flows can go to both the local, the state, and even CDC with very little effort once you have it in the right formats.
I think in all the exchanges, the public health departments have been very actively involved in the setup and also articulating what some of their needs might be from the health exchange. So they've been very, very active involved in every instance I can think of.
And maybe, David, this is a follow-up for you, but is there more potential for financial alignment here as well, as we've talked about as in other areas? So, you know, FDA is now providing some funding, and I expect some drug manufacturers are going to be providing some funding for phase four studies along the lines that we talk about for drug safety surveillance using these electronic systems. Is there CDC or other funding that could help facilitate this kind of active?
We are beginning to see some of that. And in fact, the state HIT coordinators met just a few days ago, and that was a consistent theme among all of the states, is the need for the sort of harmonizing all of the federal positions and funding opportunities. Because when you look at this, these are actually all pieces of the same larger whole. But from my colleagues on the health department side, we're beginning to see some of that come along.
And the last question.
Malcolm Lovell, the Brookings Advisory Council. My impression is that this question does not apply to the HMOs, but the healthcare is not part of the market economy. And would it be a valuable thing to require doctors to post online what they charge so that people could do some reasonable shopping? Of course, quality is something else, but at least it would bring in, how do you feel about that?
Right. I mean, so it fits with the consumer theme that you have been talking about. Better, relevant information for decision making certainly includes a cost of care. How did these steps help make that happen?
Yeah. To the extent that consumers get presented with both the cost and the quality data, we've seen in instances where they're not reimbursed by payers, like LASIK surgery is an excellent example, where the consumer becomes aware of both the economics of the procedure and the outcomes of the particular physician, and you've seen both the quality rise and the cost reduce. And I think to the extent that we make transparent to the consumer both the cost and the outcomes of the variance between providers, you will see the free market make an impact on the overall cost of healthcare.
But can you all say a little bit more about how to do that? I mean, in the spirit of the discussion so far, which is recognizing that, look, there's a lot of complex information out there. It's not all comparable. It's not subject to the same standards. Is there a piecewise approach here to giving people information they could actually use for decisions? Should it be kind of picking up on Jim's point? Should you start with some common clinical problems and try to get relevant summary information? How are we going to really accomplish this in the practical fashion that you all have been emphasizing today?
No, I think you've hit it. It's probably identify those, and it's a role that potentially government could play, is to kind of systemically identify those areas where the consumer could be more engaged in their care process and to drive the requirement of providers to provide both that cost and quality outcome data related to more narrow areas. So, but those would be the areas in which there would be the biggest cost lever for the country. So I think you can't do it globally, but picking certain areas, certain types of procedures, certain types of problems or diseases would be a great starting place.
You all doing that? Maybe bypass surgery, Jim? Or?
There's a science and set of methods for risk communication which have been almost unused in healthcare. There's a large research effort that would be needed to learn how to do that. But it's clearly a national need.
But the large research effort, that to me sounds like it's going to take a long time and not really going to fit with what's practical. You know, get some useful steps done now.
We do everything on two tracks. And so we do what we do now, and, yeah, we report things like decreased rehospitalization, decreased infection rates, how many evidence-based sub-processes in a process we get done for every patient. But we do need to address the other.
Cost information, price information?
I think so. I can't swear about that. They never tell me about costs.
Other ideas? I know it's important to your employers.
It really is. And to wit, we have been involved in a project that's an RWJ grant, Aligning Forces for Quality, where most chose to use the available claims data. We worked with others in our community to actually extract the direct clinical data from the physician office electronic health records floated over to be analyzed in a very standardized way with the published intent of making the physician report cards, if you will, transparent. So that process is underway. Because HealthBridge is also the regional extension center, we're trying to negotiate with our electronic health record vendors to essentially require that level of interoperability and output, in the contract as part of the discussion with them, so that we can flow that same kind of data much more broadly.
Well, I'd like to thank the panel. Thank all of you for some excellent questions, and thank you for the discussion this morning. And now I'd like to ask our final panel to come up. We're turning now to a discussion of taking a step back and thinking in about the policy implications of all of these steps towards making enhanced use of health information. And we're doing it from a number of different perspectives. So while people are getting up here and getting their microphones on, I'll introduce them. Andrew McLaughlin is the Deputy Chief Technology Officer at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Carol Diamond is the Managing Director of the Health Program at the Markle Foundation, where she coordinates and oversees a broad range of activities related to practical uses of electronic health information and the challenges in getting there. Landon Bain is the Director of the Clinical Data Interchange Standards Consortium HealthLink Program. And Andy Weber is the President and Chief Executive Officer of the National Business Coalition on Health. So we got everybody up to the table. We're going to start out with some opening comments from each of our panelists based on what they've heard today and some of their thoughts and views on policy steps forward for how to promote making these enhanced uses and quality improvement and healthcare system improvement happen as quickly and effectively as possible, and then again we're going to open it up for discussion. So let me start with Andrew McLaughlin.
Thanks, Mark. Let me suggest a way to structure thinking about the policy issues in health IT. So when I came to the White House last summer, I didn't know anything about health IT. What I knew about was internet systems, internet standards, and architecture. That's where I'd spent the last sort of decade working, and the parallels actually are both impressive and important. And what I mean are the parallels between the ways that we've built the internet and the way that it runs and the kind of system that we're trying to build around health IT. So in the internet, the genius of the network is that it has this extremely simple standard. It's called TCP/IP. It's basically just a way to address an arbitrary packet of data. It's got a format for data. It's to address, a from address, tells you if you've got an email, for example, it chops it up into a whole bunch of little pieces, basically sticks a number on each piece, and then sends them all out into the network where they can take many different paths to reach their destination, get reassembled in the right order, and then turned into whatever the thing you were sending was. So it could be a picture, text, video, whatever it might be. So anyway, the genius of the internet model is that it's built in a layered stack. And the layers are very distinct and very different, and that is the critical insight that makes the internet as flexible and powerful and rapidly innovating as it has been. So the internet supports a vast range of physical ways of transporting data. Copper wires, coax cables, microwave signals over the airwaves, satellite connections. Anyway, those are all different physical means that you can use to transmit some data from point A to point B. On the other side, the internet supports an incredibly vast and rich explosion of applications. As I said, everything from video to pictures to text to all the many services that are born and grow and in some cases thrive year to year. What they all have in common, though, is that it's this very simple standard common layer at the middle that makes it all possible. That's the key standard. The health IT problem is a very similar problem in one sense, which is that you have many, many different legacy systems, many vendors of different kinds of hardware, lots of operating systems, and then on the other side, a vast number of uses and applications of data that we want to be able to take advantage of. We want to be able to give it to patients, use it for comparative effectiveness research. We want to use it for billing purposes. the approach that the Congress set in motion and that the Office of the National Coordinator has been driving has been basically a health internet approach, which is to say focus on the bare minimum set of things that you have to standardize in common, and then take a very hands-off common law. Somebody, I think earlier, I think Farzad described it or alluded to a kind of common law approach where lots and lots of people were doing lots of different things, but unified around this minimum set of standards that are essential. So anyway, so for me, that kind of layered model is super useful in trying to figure out where from the policy side you need to intervene and where you don't need to intervene, where you need to push the community to reach some kind of consensus on a standard, and where you should just step back and see what emerges and where people settle. It's also a market system that we are dealing with. So market forces can be brought to bear in ways that minimize the need for the government to be involved. Anyway, so without belaboring the point, there's your layers model. The three things that I've been really focused on recently, so without making grand pronouncements, let me just talk about what I've been doing, have been privacy, security, and the sort of coordination of data problems. And these are all areas where policy really does matter. So from the patient side, from the physician side, from the researcher side, being able to trust the system is incredibly important. And that means that at the transport layer, in other words, at the layer of data moving, you have to have extraordinarily good security. On the application layer, you need to have very good privacy, which is a little bit technical and a lot social. And I'd like to talk a little bit about those. And then finally, on the coordination of information, we've heard all morning long about the different kinds of standards activities that are underway to standardize the terminology that gets used, the taxonomies that have been developed, the range of variables that can be used to describe values in different fields and so forth. So on the security side, the Internet has done a lot of the hard work for us in that there are a number of available security standards and protocols that can be used to make sure that the data going from point A to point B is not going to be interfered or tampered with. The really hard security problem, rather, is authentication, knowing that who you are communicating with is who you are supposed to be communicating with. And we have never, ever in this country built a single nationwide authentication system. We don't have national ID cards. We have a national allergy to being surveilled and tracked for very good reasons by the government, by the healthcare system, by anybody else. And so as a result, what we're going to see in this area is a range of authentication methodologies and systems that will support authentication of transactions depending on the kind of transaction, the kind of network that that you're authenticating over, and so forth. On the privacy side, let me just say that there are the privacy issues raised by health IT are shared by many of the other initiatives that the administration is pursuing. For example, in the energy sector, we're pursuing a smart grid where energy data is flowing back and forth. We are looking at the privacy issues around cell phone time and space data or location data. In other words, your cell phones are every couple, you know, a couple times every minute pinging a local tower. Your cell phone company knows where you are. And you can do extraordinary things to optimize and manage the network in very socially valuable and investment supportive ways. But it means that you have to collect a data set that is inherently identifying. So you know, if you can strip off my name, my phone number, my address, all my identifiers, but you will still know that this particular phone spends 12 hours a day over in Georgetown and 8 hours a day at the White House, or actually it's more like the other way around. But, you know, that is inherently identifying. And I think one of the most thorny, difficult problems that we face is around anonymization and de-identification. There are bits of data that are inherently identifying in the healthcare system. There are combinations of symptoms and treatments and so forth that will absolutely be unique to a given individual within a given region or a given healthcare system. And this is a big area for research. A combination of technological techniques plus social, procedural management techniques for the holders of that data is certainly going to get us to be in a good enough position. but we've got to do our best to evangelize those techniques and make sure that they're implemented. Finally, we've talked a lot about the different standards that are under development by various organizations for different parts of the problem. But I think on the policy side, the really difficult trick, as I said earlier, is figuring out where some kind of top-down coordination is necessary, where bottom-up common law-type development of standards and procedures is the right thing. And we're really only developing, on the federal side anyway, really sort of slowly developing the muscles to do it. Let me make my one final note, which is the one thing that scares me about all of this is that we are attempting to do what the Internet did over the course of about three decades in an extraordinarily compressed period of time. And that is a matter of some concern. And it means that modesty and humility and a tolerance for trial and error and some failure is going to be necessary. The problem is that failures in the area of health IT are potentially lethal, they are potentially scary, they are potentially trust-eroding, and that's why I think today's conference is important. That's why I think the level of attention that's being brought to the problem is critical and should only, if anything, be intensified.
Andrew, thanks. Carol, you want to raise our trust level?
Maybe. I think I want to thank Mark, you and your team and Brookings for putting this together, because I have a lot of takeaways from listening to the discussion this morning, and it is amazing to me how even with this at this early stage of these public investments in health IT, just listening to the panelists prior, you can really start to see that there's going to be a major paradigm shift. And I want to talk a little bit about what I mean by a paradigm shift. But first, for those of you in the audience, you know, I spent some time reflecting today on the way we traditionally have addressed quality, quality measurement, quality improvement, research. For those of you who, you know, this may not be something you spend your entire lives on, I mean, this has been a very difficult issue for U.S. healthcare. When information was based in paper, or is based in paper, I guess, still today for the most part, it is really hard to do the kinds of things that you heard about today. A typical physician in a practice, 2,000, 3,000 patients maybe, if it's all on paper and paper files on the wall somewhere, you can't walk in and say, how many of your diabetics had their eyes checked this year? Imagine doing that. Even finding the diabetics is a challenge in paper records. And I just want everybody to really appreciate that that is still the way things are done today. When Amanda mentioned HEDIS, when quality reporting is necessary at the health plan level, literally armies of people go out to physician offices, knock on the door, select a random number of those paper charts, is it still 487 or whatever the number is, and literally sit there and abstract the information and record it in paper and then bring it back and aggregate it. Same for research. You know, and by the way, the complexity and the difficulty and the cost of doing that, I think, has really gotten us away from quality improvement, because we spent all our time on quality measurement and reporting. Similarly, on the research side, it takes forever to do one of these, you know, big research studies where you have to go abstract lots of records. And typically, it's disconnected from clinical care, so maybe the statistic is the same still, which is takes 17 years between the time something's published in the medical literature in terms of advancing the way medicine should be practiced and the time it gets implemented in the physician's office. And I start there because, you know, listening to the panel today, you can really start to feel that we're on the heels of a big paradigm shift. One of the things that I think was necessary for that paradigm shift is to look at the big goal here. And Farzad started with this, and I would say the big goal for both research and quality and public health, if you will, is to allow better decisions to be made. It is not the publication of the paper. It is not the reporting of the quality measure. It is to allow better decisions to be made to improve health and healthcare. And without information systems, we have only been able to do the first step or the second step in that full cycle of information that needs to move back and forth. And I do think that what we're seeing now is getting closer and closer to having that capacity change the way we've traditionally done quality and research. It was interesting to me to listen today, even the interim stage we're at, where maybe we're using some electronic data because it's available from administrative sources. And even that has been, I would argue, still suboptimal. Administrative data sources aren't necessarily tools. They don't have decision support capability. It is merely an abstraction from a transactional system, and we're trying to use that to glean something about information. And traditionally, to do that, we've had to bring some of those administrative data sources together. The importance and the reflection I had today was that what the electronic health record or the personal health record or whatever your term of art can do to change the way we look at quality and research is that it takes the computing power, if you will, the knowledge creation power, all the way out to the user, as opposed to what we traditionally have had to do, which is to collect all that data from out there, bring it in somewhere centrally that had the capacity to crunch it and figure out what was in it. It really puts the computing power out at the edges. And I think because of that, you're starting to see research methodologies that are really changing. The HMO Research Network is a good example. We have very sophisticated holders of information. We no longer have to go get all their information and bring it in one place. We are very capable today of saying, instead of bringing all the data to the question all the time, let's push the question to the data. It's faster, it's cheaper, and I get the results a lot, you know, in a lot more real time. And maybe most importantly, and most importantly for quality improvement, is that the person who can actually make a decision to use that information has it. Traditionally, in quality reporting and research, somebody comes or you report some data, you have no idea sort of what the results are. The study takes a long time. Maybe you get something back a year later, a year and a half later. It happens once a year, if we're talking about HEDIS. You don't have the capacity to generate that knowledge within your own practice as a physician. And what these tools provide is the capability to do that. I'm also going to say that I think it will profoundly change the role of patients. And I love listening to Jim about sort of moving the patient's activities from the waiting room to the living room. You don't need to sit in the waiting room to fill out the clipboard. Using the patient as a source of information, literally for quality, for research, all this stuff is capable. You know, the intermediate step, just as there was an intermediate step with administrative data, trying to use that on its own. The intermediate step is, you know, I remember there was a big push to try to get kiosks out in the waiting room. Maybe the patient could use a kiosk to enter this information. And the capacity to not need that anymore and to really look at the patient as an integral part of generating this information, I think is going to profoundly change things. I will tell you that 4 or 5 years ago at Markle, we started developing a view about information networks and distributed models and built based on internet principles, just as you well described. We really laid out a set of principles based on fair information practices and distributed data sources. We called it distributed but queryable, that all the information didn't have to be in one place, but you could ask questions. We sort of laid out that vision, but we were so far from being able to really see large numbers of entities participate in that way, that it seemed like a very far-off thing, at least for population health. And over the years, I mean, some of the things you heard today, the HMO Research Network, the distribute effort that we helped to support that was being worked on by the New York City Health Department, many of the examples that you heard today are increasingly figuring out ways to take these distributed information sources, not collect the data, not expose identifying information, but use the computing power that's now available at the edges and really start to shift the way we think about these things. The other thing I wanted to just mention was that for a long time, we really emphasized the importance of the network and the connectivity and not the EHR. And the reason for that was in order to really improve quality or to give the patient what they want or to support what you heard earlier, which is, you know, everybody has different needs from information. You know, I desperately want immunization records from my daughter's school camp forms. If anybody can get me that electronically, I'll take it. But other people have different needs. And the only way to support that and also support the kind of information I might need to make, you know, health decisions is to leverage a network and to not rely on one source to give you all the information you need. And I think, you know, that's what you're starting to see at the systems level as well, where they are not relying on the physician to remember to give out the reminders for flu, but the systems infrastructure is able to say to the patient, it's time for a flu shot. You know, you're due. And getting better results, which has been something we've known for a very long time, that when you send reminders to the physician to tell their patient something versus send it directly to the patient, you get a much higher blip in the results. So I'm excited about what this all means, and I guess the big shift for me today is while we were trying to promote the idea that we had to leverage networks and distributed models and that you didn't need to collect all the data centrally, there's an inevitability that will happen because so much power will happen as these, computing power, literally, will happen as these tools get rolled out to physicians. It bridges the gap between physician and researcher. It sort of makes those roles even closer. And it involves them in the results, which has been the holy grail for quality improvement. So, all good.
Thanks. That's a positive outlook on all this. Thank you, Carol. Andy?
Well, thank you, Mark, and thanks for the invite today. My daddy always used to say you sort of are where you sit. So let me tell you my perspective first. I'm here representing the business community, and thank you, Robert, for talking about employers. I appreciate that very much. We're a national association of about 57 employer-based coalitions around the country, and we are trying to help the employer community get to two end goals. One is improving the health and productivity of their workforce, because that's a competitive advantage. And number two, we are trying to deal with rising employer costs associated with the burden of illness and are reflected not just by healthcare claims, but as Robert talked about, lost productivity, absenteeism, all the things that, again, go into making a business enterprise successful. So just a little bit of a perspective. And of course, the employer community nor myself are experts on health information technology, but certainly the business community understands because they see it in their own industries, how information technology can transform business enterprises, and are actually shocked by the fact when they learn that the largest sector of the American economy has not sort of entered this new world. And, you know, sort of what's wrong with that as a picture? So anyway, that is just sort of a sort of framing perspective. But let me just sort of respond to what I've heard. And I think this was supposed to be a response panel. And talk about some of the principles and maybe, as you're suggesting, Mark, some of the policy implications. You know, and it's almost a cliche. I start with health information technology not being an end in itself, but as an enabler. And that, as the first speaker said this morning, we really do need to start with the aims of what we're trying to accomplish here. And Robert, I do think it's a triple aim. I think it's population health improvement. I think it's transformation of the healthcare delivery system towards higher quality, towards being more patient-centered, being more efficient. And if we do those two things well, and including the healthcare delivery system being more focused on population health, thank you, George, for your comment on prevention, because part of this transformation of healthcare delivery is to move us away from acute care focus to a prevention focus. If we do those two things well, and I guess I'm a Boy Scout here, I believe we can get to cost containment as an end goal. And I believe all those things are key to our economic competitiveness as a society, our economic security, and we've got to start there. And in terms of policy implications, and I think healthcare reform legislation really talked to this, we need to set some goals in those arenas. And you know, in terms of explicit goals for cost containment, for population health improvement, for transformation of healthcare delivery, and then work back from there. And by the way, that happens not just, as I'll say in a second, at a federal level, perhaps with aligned incentives along that way, but these are all the goals that we need to set in local communities as well. Principle number two is that I still get a flavor, even though I love the conversation in the most recent panel, that health information technology is not just to service the healthcare delivery system and providers in particular. And it's not just about an electronic health record. It is, as Carol just said in the group, we've got a, as we talked about, a patient-centered healthcare, we need a consumer-centered health information technology system that really services the individual at the end of the day. And we need to recognize that it is individual behaviors that have more of an influence on health status than anything the healthcare delivery system can do. You know, it is the issues, George, thank you again, of diet and exercise and drinking responsibly and self-management and being compliant with the treatment regimen. How many times have I heard the doctor come to the microphone and say, I did everything right with my patient. I told them, put them on the right meds. I sent them out the door after my 7-minute visit. And it's on the individual. And it's the individual that is screwing up here in terms of not getting to the outcomes that we need. So we need health information technology, I think, to be consumer-centric and to support the decision-making that not just providers are making, but the decisions that individuals have to make. I just, in that regard, saw a very exciting presentation by Mayo Clinic about their new system of email visits. And I mean, you talk about transformation of healthcare. I don't think if we go 20 years in the future, even 10 years in the future, we're going to have a healthcare delivery system focused on a 7-minute visit. I think it will be connected in that way. And that will lead to more continuous care, integrated care, patient activation as we've seen it. Two other points. I do want to emphasize the principle of leadership engagement at a local community level. And it's not leadership and great engagement around HIE. It's, as, again, Robert, you were describing, getting all the key stakeholders, demand side and supply side, together at a leadership level, talking about the end goals, and then talking, yes, about information systems to support it. That's sort of the governance infrastructure that I think we'll need to progress. And I think those solutions from communities are going to be a little different. And this gets to the policy side. The fragile balance between federal regulation and standardization and the need to give the marketplace and local communities some flexibility. And I think that's going to be a policy struggle as we go along. And I know I'm over my time. It says N right there. But I'm here representing the folks paying the bills. And, at the end of the day, it is about getting what you pay for. And that theme has come through today. We've got to get to economic alignment. We've got to reward providers and fundamentally change the payment system away from fee-for-service towards bundled payments, towards more capitated arrangements that will really, in terms of payment, encourage the more integrated patient-centered delivery system that we need. And by the way, shame on us, the employer community, for not taking greater ownership of that issue. In terms of policy implications, I think, payment reform and alignment of incentives for consumers as well through particularly value-based benefit design concepts has got to be a big part of the solution. And I worry in terms of policy development here, particularly that you know, the payers will move in different directions, and we've got to have harmonization between where Medicare and Medicaid's doing and what private sector payers are doing in terms of not moving towards unintended consequences. So again, economic alignment, I think the best way to sustain and move towards adoption of HIT and meaningful use of HIT is if we get the incentives aligned.
Thanks, Thank
you.
Andy. Landon?
So I'm Landon Bain. I work with CDISC, which is a global standards development organization for medical research. And I'm focused on the secondary use of EHR data for clinical research, which Carol mentioned several times. And I work in the integrated systems engineering capacity. So most of the time I'm thinking about much more technical and standards-based sort of nitty-gritty kinds of problems. So when I was invited to speak to a policy question, it was like,
oh no,
got the bins or something. But interestingly enough, in the work that I'm doing right now, I would say that policy is lagging behind technology. I will tell you, and if you don't believe me, please give me a chance to convince you otherwise, that we have adequate standards, good, straightforward technology. We have a roster of commercial EHRs who are avid to participate. We have a roster of research systems, electronic data capture systems and so forth, that are avid to participate. The thing that is holding us back is actually policy issues. We have approaches that have been tested here in the States and in Europe and in Japan. We have approaches that have been demonstrated all around the world. We have pilot programs that have been successful. And when I say policy, I'm not even sure I know what that word means. But what really inhibits EHRs from submitting data directly into the research world is fear. The FDA casts a much darker shadow than what they know they do. I actually demonstrated some of these approaches to some folk at the FDA last spring, and they were saying, well, why aren't more people doing this? And I said, well, it's because there are people out there are afraid of you. They're afraid of getting clobbered. They're afraid that if they're the first pharma to submit data that have been pulled out of an EHR, that somebody's going to invoke the ultimate boogeyman, 21 CFR 11, and say these data were not sourced properly. Therefore, you have to go flush them away and start over again. The pharma are horribly afraid of being the first to adopt something new. I actually had a conversation with a research institute that they called me and said, can you help us convince this sponsor, the pharma sponsor, I won't say its name, but the initials are GSK, that had brought a bunch of monitors in and said, you know, we can't take data from you guys because you're deriving it out of the EHR. You know, and the EHR is not 21 CFR compliant. So they asked me to help with that as a friendly standards guy, and I said, I really can't do that. I wish I could. I desperately wish I could. But if I could convey a message to the policy community, and particularly to the FDA, it's that when I hear the FDA and many, many times the bright lights at the executive level doing their PowerPoint say very, very encouraging things. And they say, you know, let's go forward with this, let's make it happen. That's not who we're afraid of. It's the monitor that somehow didn't get the word, right, who comes to the site and squelches some creative work just by being a, you know, a conscientious, cautious regulator. So I would ask that the FDA speak with one voice, that they find some modest ways to ameliorate the risk of people who could adopt these existing standards and existing technologies, clarify some basic issues about what constitutes a source document and when do we have to have something under 21 CFR 11 or not. And then back to Andrew's point earlier about privacy and security, what constitutes an adequate privacy layer, which is a project that I'm actually working on right now, where we could actually have an identified research database that we could search and then contact those patients about engaging in clinical research. What constitutes proper privacy preference and policy reflection? And there's standards that are being developed along those lines as well. My last comment is that I've got an opportunity later this month to go to Singapore and in July to go to Japan. And in both of those settings, the equivalent of FDA is engaged in a project to look at a research network that's drawing data directly out of an EHR. We could do that here. Mm-hmm. We could do it here this summer, right? But everybody's afraid. So Singapore or Japan or both are going to do this first. And it's a pity because all of the approaches to doing this were developed here. And I really wish that we could have not a major policy move, just some clarity and some encouragement that if you try something new and you're the first to do it, you're not the first to get clobbered.
So. Thanks, Lynn. I think you illustrated why the technical standards emphasis does fit right into this policy discussion. You know, all of you in your comments, whether it's applications related to research or to prevention or to quality improvement or to public health types of issues, all of you have emphasized in one way or another that technically it's possible to do these things now, that we really are on the edge of a transformation, as Carol said, but that to actually get there from here is going to take flexibility on the one hand, but also some consistency and guidance on the other. And if I see heads nodding, I wonder if you all might push this a little bit further. I mean, if we are going to make this transformation happen sooner rather than later, you've got to take those general principles and turn them into practical applications to get down that road.
Carol? Yeah, you know, I was thinking, reflecting on your question and also listening to the others, that we could miss the opportunity if we make one of three mistakes. And I think those mistakes are imposing old paradigms toward, you know, the information and the sort of the world we are coming from, which is data silos and things that are walled off and sealed off, to what is potentially a more connected and network environment. If we fail to develop the policies and the policy framework that basically establish the fair information practices, the rules of the road for how to take advantage of this potential. And similarly, on the technical side, if we apply sort of old enterprise paradigms toward technology and standards instead of web, you know, internet-based network networked approaches that really do separate very important things from a technological perspective, that would create the kind of flexibility that that I think we need.
Yeah. Or we can make all three of those mistakes.
It has happened.
Andrew, any comments on how to avoid the mistakes and get down this road to transformation?
I mean, actually, one of the things that this morning's panel really brought out was that in particular regions, particular geographies, the multi-layered integrated approach is underway. So what Dr. Halamka has been doing, what Mr. Walker's been doing, you know, in South Carolina and the four-state area of Pennsylvania and so forth. Anyway, so you've got was Pennsylvania one of
them? Ohio.
Ohio.
Cincinnati.
Indiana.
Cincinnati.
So anyway, but so you can draw, you know, so the interesting thing is you can draw, you know, sort of a circle on a map, and you can say that a variety of healthcare institutions within that circle are making it work. And I think actually I really liked what Mr. Walker said about, you know, trust the intelligence of the teams.
Yes.
And be very skeptical of the systems designers and software writers to figure this all out ahead of time. That's exactly right.
Exactly.
So, anyway, so that's awesome. What I noticed, though, in to the extent that I'm able to kind of dig into the details, is that we've got a bunch of customized systems being built. Now, they're better than a single institution because they're crossing institutions and bringing in, you know, clinical practices and sole practitioners and academic practitioners and hospitals, whatever. They're building a system that they can all talk to. This looks to me, by the way, a lot like the early days of the internet too, when you had BitNet and ARPANET and NYSERNET, and anyway, these different networks that were all independently humming along. And then the grand project of the kind of the late 80s, early 90s was to thread them all together into a single internet. So the good news is that that project seems eminently doable to me, in part because of the fact that we've got this sort of high-low approach of, you know, like the Health IT Standards Committee and formerly HITSB, which is, you know, a very high-level attempt to get this right at a broad-level generality, and then lots of implementations down in the weeds, and then, you know, lots of people that are doing both, like Dr. Holomka, actually trying to build it and trying to do the standards and so forth, allows you to run back and forth. Anyway, so that's kind of the world that we live in. I think the interesting challenge for policy, again, is to figure out where the barriers lie. Like, what are the things where people are just not doing it because they're unclear about what the rules are? So you can set a rule. They're unclear about what the standard should apply. You set a standard. And, you know, one thing I just want to set on the table, which is just super important, is that the cost of computing power continues to plummet.
Yep.
The cost of bandwidth continues to plummet. The information technology sector, in that sense, is a declining cost business, thanks to Moore's law, and so forth. We can pack more computing power into the same chip for the same amount of money, in the same size, every year. So the advantage is that you can start to use that law of economics to do a lot of stuff that otherwise would have been a painful systems mm-hmm. engineering project out in the given institutions or even the given geographies. And that, I think, is what's going to get us sort of over the next couple of years. In one sense, we are now absolutely eminently able to run large cloud-based systems that can take a word-perfect file on an FTP server, grab it, make some intelligent guesses about what's inside, structure the data, add metadata to it, and pull it into the repository that you want, or make it available in a federated system to the people who are querying it. Anyway, that's now possible. So the old problem, which is get the standard, get it absolutely set, get it right, is not really the problem. Instead, we've got each of the different systems here today capable, at low cost and with relatively small amounts of software engineering, to link their systems together, understand what the differences in the metadata are, and so forth. So that's a kind of like optimistic answer to how I think we can get there, how we are getting there.
Thank you. Well, and you know, the only thing that I would add is, Landon, maybe we can learn from other countries in terms of how to do it. And, you know, you expressed a concern about being first one in. Maybe it's a good thing that mm-hmm. some international countries are going first, and we can see how they resolve these barriers. I also think that there, you know, we need some public education here, that there are cultural issues related to particularly how the public perceives and the immediate threats in their mind of rapid, you know, dissemination of information that might relate to their own. And I do think we need more of a national and public conversation and really a public education a campaign to explain how this can transform individual health. That this is, you know, can be a good thing. We need security and privacy protections, and I agree that needs to be standardized. But I don't think, you know, Joe Public understands the power of what we're talking about in terms of really engaging them and moving us towards greater health status. So I think that's part of the solution.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Any final questions or comments from those of you who are here?
Hi, Mike Squires from Blueprint Healthcare IT. My question this morning is, there's been discussion about consumers and large IDNs and institutions. Since most practice in this country occurs among small physician practices, very small physician practices, and even with regional extension centers moving to bring people into the loop, what's going to help change the ways physicians individually practice themselves? Besides just collecting data and sharing data, what do we need to do on a policy end to help physicians think differently and treat work with their patients differently?
So I think we've learned a lot already, and I think, you know, Amanda and John, and they have experience, and Jim, in sort of seeing how this paradigm shift happens. The key from my perspective in terms of giving them the capacity to use these tools in a way that provides value to them is to not make quality and research a compliance exercise, but to make it part of the way care is delivered. And the only way I know how to do that is to give them the tools at the point of care while they're with the patient and give them the flexibility to use those tools toward common goals. I mean, Jim started to describe some of that in terms of how they're starting to shift now in terms of giving the capacity of care teams to use the tools the way that they see fit. And I do think those are the kinds of changes that are necessary. Because, as you know, quality really up until this point, quality reporting, it's been a compliance thing, right? You have to do it. Somebody comes in, they abstract the chart. But it's not really integrally related to the way care is practiced. And we heard a lot about practice flow and not disrupting that. There's also a need to redesign that flow and redesign those care processes. And I think only with some of these, with some of the learnings from these systems, can you begin to understand how to do that. So I don't think it's going to be an easy road. I just don't know another way to get there.
And yeah, Jim. Wait for the mic.
Sorry. Following what was said, part of this really is about processes. And if you think about how are we going to reimburse people for participating in an end-to-end process to the patient looks seamless, but is actually the result of five or six or seven different owned entities participating in the appropriate way at the appropriate time, with knowledge of what everybody else has done and what's going to be done next, it seems to me that we're going to have to get to where we can characterize those care processes specifically enough, particularly the interfaces. How soon does the mammogram have to go from the place where it's taken to the person who's going to read it, and how fast do they have to report a normal back to the patient electronically? If we could characterize those processes and then decide what each sub-process is reimbursable for, then you would have a natural mechanism to do what we're talking about, which is to encourage everybody to take their part, know that it's the core of their work, it isn't something extraneous now, and be clear on what it's going to mean.
Well, as Andy said, we're not paying for that now, and we really need to move to doing it. And Landon, I assume the standards can help us get there, too.
The standards are going to help us get there. But what I wanted to also respond to has been very encouraging to me today, that there's been a lot of discussion about workflow and business process. I think there was a time not too long ago when only data mattered. And data, it was as if data, Clint McDonald talks about the spontaneous generation of data. And it doesn't come out of nowhere. It comes from business processes. And it's a very, very rich source of exploration for us to come up with standardization of business process and integration of business process across sites. So that I really am encouraged that we've moved off of what I call data blindness, where all you can think about is just data and this abstract quality that you want to get a hold of. So.
Mm-hmm. And I think, Amanda, since you're dealing with a lot of these community-based providers, yeah, I'll give you the last word on this.
Actually, I was going to ask a question to Andrew. I'm happy to address the question around how, what kind of policies needs we would, what kind of policy changes would need to be in place to affect small, in particular, small practices. But frankly, it just has to be alignment of health reform and reimbursement, right? It's a patient-centered medical home. You've got to start giving a primary care provider a reason to take an email and defray a face-to-face visit. You've got to figure out how to put them, how you can protect them from the legal liabilities of accessing potentially hundreds of pages of information through a health information exchange that they don't even have the time to sift through.
Really supporting that whole end-to-end process thing, right, that Jim, yeah, change that Jim was talking, mm-hmm, about.
My question, though, was for Andrew. As you think about the way the federal government as a payer has stepped up to provide incentives for electronic medical record adoption through the meaningful use incentives, where do you see the role of the commercial payers, the employers, to step up and cover their part as well?
And do that as, no, very good question. I get that question asked a lot. And we do think we need to make a contribution. But let me start with the principle first. And that is, I think a lot of people in the private sector believe that, you know, if we got the payment system right and we really created incentives for better outcomes, chronic care management, that would create the platform and the business model and the economic incentive for the delivery system to be investing in its own technology to begin with. I mean, it's not the normal sort of business model that you would sort of subsidize for a care delivery system, mm-hmm, the infrastructure that they should own. But it's all because we screwed up the incentives that now we've got stimulus bill and lots of support, and that's a good thing. So let me start with that principle, that I believe that if we got the payment system right, it would create its own energy towards greater technology. And how many times have we said that this morning? Let's get the payment incentives right. Having said that, I think that we have a responsibility. At NBCH, for example, we have a common RFI called the Evaluate Tool that measures the performance of healthcare plans. And we're asking our coalitions and their employers to be saying to their carriers, their payers, Aetna, United, all the big ones, what are you doing to create the right incentives? What are you doing to subsidize and help support? What percentage of your provider network are wired? And sort of set some expectations from the ultimate purchaser. Remember, the fiscal intermediary is simply that, a fiscal intermediary. It's someone else's dollars that they're spending. So we have to set those sorts of expectations. So we're building that into our Evaluate tool to sort of send the message that the payer should become more involved.
So it's happening. Yeah. I think that's a good note to end on. Now, I'd like to ask you all and you all to stay where you are for just a couple more minutes, but I'd very much like to thank our panel for leading a great discussion to end this up on today. Thank you all very much. We've covered a lot of ground. You do a lot of these events. The ones on health IT are always very challenging because there are so many issues that come to bear.
Right.
Everyone has said this is not an end in itself. It's a way to get to where we really want our healthcare system to go. But that, of course, opens up the discussions to covering just about every single major issue in the healthcare system. And I think our panelists all day did a terrific job of bringing that all together in a way that not only lays out the challenges and the problems, but also suggest some important ways forward. And I tend to be a little bit optimistic by nature, and I'm going to leave this event with a bit of optimism that we are at the edge of a major paradigm shift, as Carol said, that it really is not only about to happen, but you can see it starting to happen now. To paraphrase Vice President Biden, this is a big deal, and it is. At the same time, it is very much a work in progress. We're not just going to get here to there easy. easily. It's not a, there's not a magic bullet simple solution, as Farzad emphasized this morning, and how they are approaching policy issues. And I think this came out in some of Andrew's comments as well. You got to make it simple, stupid, but not stupid. And that's hard to do right, but there sure are a lot of clear, meaningful, feasible opportunities to do it now, whether it's around changing the processes for certain kinds of preventive care, consumer-oriented care, whether it's around some common disease problems and quality improvement for those, whether it's around some public health issues or possible research questions. We're at the point where we're not only identifying these clear, definite, important, incremental, but important steps forward, but we're actually at a point where we can do it, where the standards are there. Technically, it's possible to do, and it's starting to happen because of both the steps like the broad-based stakeholder involvement that many of our panelists have emphasized today, and the simultaneous alignment of incentives. Andy kept coming back to this, as many others did, appropriately, and it really has been sort of a chicken and an egg problem in the past. We have these siloed ways of delivering care without much coordination in place, so that's naturally the way that you pay, but if that's the way that you pay, that tends to be what you get. Well, by making these changes in processes and by having feedback, recognizing we're not going to do it perfectly, that standards may not be applied in a comprehensive way, but there is a way to do it that can move forward, and bring incentives along with it, we really have an opportunity to move forward. As Jim said, your term was the cumulative effect of a range of HHS actions, a range of new legislation, really are at the point now where it's kind of approaching critical mass and the ability to really support these kinds of specific meaningful changes that add up. And similarly, as Andy emphasized, it's getting increasingly clear to employers, to the purchasers, to the private sector, that they can and, in fact, must take some of these steps at the same time. So it's no longer a chicken and egg problem, but it's a simultaneous alignment of sort of a feedback process for making real steps and real progress on changing the way that care is delivered using health IT, with changing incentives at the same time, and that's incentives across the board, not just payment for services, but for public health and for quality improvement and for better evidence and the like. So there are some reasons to think that we can move forward, and I really want to thank all of you for getting us to this point in the discussion and in the process here today. That thanks goes to all of you in the audience as well. There's some terrific questions and comments. I particularly appreciated your efforts to make sure that this discussion got back to the real bottom line focus on patients, on consumers, on getting the best possible care to people. Also, a special thanks to the Markle Foundation for supporting this event, and the Brookings team who made it possible, Ed Walters, Megan Carey, Bryn Barnett, Aaron Weirater, Beth Rafferty, Josh Benner, and especially our new team member who hopefully isn't going to run away after all the work from putting this together, Karen Matsuoka, who did a terrific job. So thanks to all of them and all of you. More from us. This is not going to be the last word, obviously. We're in the midst of a very important process of transformational change. One next step from us is going to be a white paper that's going to reflect the themes and principles that we discussed today, and you should expect that's going to highlight a number of the practical, sort of keep it simple opportunities to bring together both changes in care delivery and changes in the financial and other support and key regulatory obstacles as well. So look for that to come. And thanks again for all of your efforts to help us move down this road. It's not easy to transform healthcare, and health IT isn't going to do it by itself, but there's some very good opportunities, some very good building blocks in place, and we look forward to continuing to work with all of you in the weeks and months ahead as we make this vision a reality. Thank you all again, and have a great weekend. Thank you.